our day across these five cities. U.S. competitiveness in the global markets, China is a superpower, presidential politics, civil rights and race relations, does God exist? And now, gluttony. And who better on this topic than Atlantic senior editor Corby Kummer, the man who has written in our pages about, just a few things, organic yogurt, Alaskan wild salmon, artisan bacon, heirloom poultry, Tuscan-style olive oil, true wild rice, sustainable pork, grass-fed beef, smoked sable fish, quinoa soup, Maine potatoes, and many, many other topics. A little taste of Corby from the July-August issue, for those of you who have not seen it, a piece on online grocery shopping. Corby writes, "Convenience trumps ideals in everyday life, and sometimes the farmer's market is inconvenient. Sometimes you long for the days when phone numbers had five digits and city grocers wrote down your delivery list with soft-leaded pencils on brown paper bags. Those days are over, and we're actually here to talk about technology in the kitchen and the challenges and opportunities that presents." Let me give a moment introduction to Corby. As I mentioned, he's senior editor of The Atlantic. He's been with The Atlantic since 1981. He is one of the most widely read, authoritative, and creative food writers in the United States. His 1990 book, The Joy of Coffee, was called the most definitive and engagingly written books on the subject to date by the New York Times. And his more recent book, The Pleasures of Slow Food, celebrates the slow food movement and artisanal growing and food preparation techniques. Corby was restaurant critic of New York Magazine across 1995 and 1996, and since 1997, he's been the restaurant critic for Boston Magazine. He was educated at Yale and has been the recipient of three James Beard Journalism Awards, including the MFK Fisher Distinguished Writing Award. And he's here to moderate our panel today. So I'll turn things over to you, my friend.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth, and thank you all very much for coming. We're really glad to see you. We've got this terrific group of people who probably need no introduction, but let me introduce them. Mario Batali, familiar to you all, creates magic in his many New York hotspots. Babbo Ristorante, which we were just talking about, it opens at 4:30 tomorrow, so we might see you all at 4:30 tomorrow. And Enoteca and Enoteca Greenwich Village. He was honored as best new restaurant of 1998 by the James Beard Foundation, which kind of is a theme in all of our lives, the James Beard Foundation. Other restaurants include Lupa, Esca, Otto Enoteca Pizzeria, Casa Mono, Bar Jamon, and Del Posto, along with Italian wine merchants, which I frequent. Mario apprenticed with London's legendary chef Marco Pierre White and spent 3 years of intense culinary training in the northern Italian village of Borgo Capanne, which is actually going to come up today. Mario hosts two Food Network programs, Molto Mario and Ciao America, and has authored Simple Italian Food, Mario Batali Holiday Food, The Babbo Cookbook, and Molto Italiano. Most recently, he created the first ever cookbook for NASCAR fans. This is news to me. Mario tailgates NASCAR style. Is this true? It must be true. I mean, it's right in your bio. Wow, Dan. Dan Barber, who is Mario's backdoor neighbor downtown, that's the route we all want to be able to travel, right? Began farming and cooking for family and friends at Blue Hill Farm in the Berkshires. In 2002, Food and Wine magazine featured him as one of the country's best new chefs. And he's addressed food system issues through op-eds in the New York Times. Since May of 2000, Dan's seen Blue Hill grow from a noted neighborhood restaurant to recently receiving a 3-star New York Times review. Both Blue Hill and Blue Hill at Stone Barns, where Dan just drove down from about 10 seconds ago, have received Best New Restaurant nominations from James Beard Foundation, and the spring of this year, he was awarded Best Chef New York City. Dan serves on Harvard's Center for Health and the Global Environment Advisory Board, so come to Boston and visit us. Barbara Kafka, the author of, who I have to say is one of my best friends in the world, though I'm not supposed to admit it, is the author of award-winning books her readers swear by, among them Vegetable Love, winner of the 2006 IACP, that's International Association of Cooking Professionals, award for Best Single Subject Cookbook, Roasting a Simple Art, which is probably on everybody's shelves here, won the Julia Child Cookbook Award, and Microwave Gourmet, which a landmark book that will come up in our discussions today. She was a regular contributor to the New York Times and has written extensively for food magazines in the United States, Great Britain, and Australia, including a monthly column the opinionated palette for gourmet and others for Family Circle and Vogue. Go out and buy the opinionated palette, a book that was collected. It's one of the great collections of food writing. In the past, Barbara was active as a consultant to restaurants, industry, and as a product designer. For many years, she taught with James Beard and around the country on her own. So obviously, we could talk about just anything with this incredibly distinguished group, but I've chosen a subject not dear to many people's hearts, including people right here on stage, which is technology, technology in the kitchen, which we can't escape reading about. You can't escape reading about it if you open The Atlantic this month, because I have a piece about sous vide, vacuum packing, cooking meats under the sous vide technology, which has taken hold in almost everyone's kitchens except, I believe, Mario's. We just have to know about it. If we're thinking about food now, we've got to know about these machines and where it can be. So I'm going to start with Mario. I have broad questions about this. And the techniques you used when you worked in Italy, training, the ones your father uses making his sausages. If you all go to Seattle, you've got to go to Armandino before 4:30 in the afternoon, right? It's a lunch-only place. Just remember this when you're going to Seattle. Lunch only at Mario's father's, Armandino's, for home-cured sausages and home-cured meats. And just, do they make the ragouts and stews that we had? They are incredible ragouts and stews. But you know that you don't associate them with anything to do with high tech. So the techniques your father uses making his sausages and cured meats, the ones you use now, where do machines help you, and where have you decided that they actually hurt?
The machines make excellent espresso. They can be trusted to roll out the pasta. They can churn gelato, and they can freeze things quite nicely. We use a machine to keep the hot water boiling for our cooking of the pastas. That's about it. That's all we have.
That's a real, you know, laying out.
Refrigerator?
Well, refrigerating and freezers, yes.
They not only freeze things, they refrigerate
things.
No
oven?
The oven comes under the stove, yes. But I don't consider that a machine. That's more just a box of fire.
So, all right, we've got Barbara already.
I mean, I don't want to sound like a neo-Luddite. I'm not against technology. I just haven't figured it out, all of it.
And Barbara was one of the first people to think about ovens and, you know, what's our definition of an oven and what can a microwave do and not do. But also, I want to take you back to the food processor, because as far as I know, Barbara wrote the first book about cooking with food processors when...
No, I edited a magazine for Carl Sondheimer.
That's it. Who brought the Cuisinart
and
to this country?
And I contributed to Jim Beard's book for the food processor.
And you were thinking then about what do knives do and not do?
And well, you see, the thing is, I asked Mario that not just to be provocative, although it comes with my territory.
Comes naturally to it.
But I said it because I think that we define technology almost per se as something that is new to us. I would claim that the technological advance of the patent stove, the closed stove, wood-fired or whatever, was the most liberating thing that ever happened to women. Mm-hmm. Because you didn't have to stay up all night to feed the fire, you didn't have to get down on your knees to stoke the damn thing, and you could, it would heat the water, and it really was liberating. So, but we don't consider that technology anymore. The refrigerator, when it first came, everybody assumed the gases were going to kill us. The same thing was true of electricity. They thought electricity was going to come out of the wall. I mean,
sometimes it does.
Well, yeah, Corby, but, you know, gas, yes, electricity is not liable to do you in. Coming out of the wall, unless it's a lightning strike. But the thing is that we've grown accustomed to these things, so we don't consider them technology anymore. The food processor is a very interesting phenomenon. It drove the Cannell off the upscale menu. In other words, Cannell used to be necessary, you know, that forcemeat dumpling thing, that a fish that has to be
floats
poached.
Floats in soup.
And, Well, or has a wonderful Nantua sauce. It's a great, great delicacy. I adore it still. But the point was that it used to be so difficult that only the fanciest restaurants would make it. Suddenly, any idiot with a food processor could make it. Well, where was the réclame in that? You know, that sort of thing. So that was an interesting thing. It's terrible at chopping onions because it exerts so much pressure that it forces the juice out. And the same thing is true of herbs. But to tell you the honest to God truth, I write for the home cook. I am a home cook. If I can get a meal out, if I can make something that tastes pretty good, I'm going to be happy with it. And the food processor is a great invention. And I'm sure you have one in your kitchen.
Yes.
And what do you use it for?
Vinaigrettes, making breadcrumbs, grinding chocolate, anything.
Nuts.
I mean, a thousand things, but yeah. Not herbs, not onions.
No.
I mean,
right.
There's things that just don't make sense with it, but things that have to be reduced quickly to small, relatively
pieces.
Considerate pieces, or consistent pieces, is that it?
You have a food processor, Barber?
I do.
And
yeah,
you, what do you use it for?
The same things, no herbs, no onions, but pretty much everything
right.
else.
So the answer is we're basically agreed that there are things that don't work in any form of technology. I mean, it's like toasting marshmallows. There are a lot of things you're not going to put on a stick and stick in a fire, even if it's a green stick. So
sounds good to me, though. Now, we're getting back to...
The microwave.
It sounds, no, we'll wait for the microwave, right. And we'll go over to sous vide. Because one of the things that Barbara always comes up with, provocative ideas... is that eventually what becomes the great luxury is actually doing things by hand. That once these machines become part of everyone's life and everybody has the same shortcut so that making a quenelle is no longer a sign that you're in a Grand Luxe restaurant. In fact, anybody can do it who buys
But they can.
But they can all do it. So having something, you know, that's incredibly labor intensive, we like have to go to a Mario restaurant for it. You know, we have to find somebody who's willing to invest the money in hand work for it. But I want to talk about transformation of cuisine and how you conceive of a dish. And I'm going to get to you and microwaves and how it changed your conception of thinking through how you make a dish. But I want to ask Dan, who uses a lot of sous vide. Mm. And, you know, explain it briefly for how it attracted to you in the first place. And now how it's changed the dishes you make, because you were classically trained before sous vide became a part of everybody's vocabulary.
Well, it doesn't change the way I conceive of a dish. I would say that all the dishes were conceived without sous vide and then added to or benefited from sous vide. So that's a big difference.
Give us an example of how it benefits.
Well,
a dish.
Pork belly is a good...
Well, I think, first of all, what the hell is sous vide?
Cryovacking.
But cryovacking and cooking at any guaranteed temperature? I mean, I think there was a big issue recently when they went into Momofuku, for example, and threw away everything that had been cryovac but not measured and not done with a HACCP system. Is sous vide a technique now, or is it a style of cooking? I think it's just a technique,
right? They came
into
Blue Hill and threw away everything, even though it was measured and temperatured as well. So
that's just them not knowing the rules,
and
right?
And Dan developed the first HACCP plan. So he's been the leader in developing HACCP plans to under permits, he can actually do this in his restaurant.
That's right.
But so why are you attached to it?
Well, to sous vide.
Yeah, why did you
well,
actually
I'm just sold on the taste. It was very, very simple in the end. I mean, I just said the flavors of a piece of, let's say, pork belly, which I was just giving an example of, that is braised in a traditional pork belly stock with vegetables, is a delicious cut of meat. It's even more delicious cooked sous vide. I mean, it's as simple as that. And
why?
Well, I think the reason is two. For one, when you braise a pork belly, you are losing by virtue of the braise some of the flavor of the belly within the broth that you're braising it in. When you blanch a carrot in water to cook it. It's a delicious carrot when it's cooked properly in well-salted water, but you're also losing some of the carrot flavor in the water. So number one, sous vide is a dry environment. and you are retaining the taste, the true taste of the carrot or of the pork belly within that bag. And then second, you have control where you don't have control in a big kitchen, especially if you have 200 restaurants. You can't possibly control a 22-year-old cook blanching a carrot. Who goes off to take a telephone call and comes back and takes carrot out of the water and shocks it. You can have precise number of minutes at a precise temperature, and your carrot will essentially be the same every time you cook it.
You know, it's funny because the argument you're making preserves the true flavor. It's like the truest carrot you can get because you're not losing anything, you know, despite the delicious soups that can result. You just want that carrot flavor. Isn't that also what drove your interest in the microwave, your artichoke revelation?
He could easily be describing microwave cookery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In other words, if you seal your container with cling film, if you're British, or plastic wrap, you are making a sous vide, basically.
Right.
And you have total control. There was a study. There was a woman at Cornell at the university, and I'm terribly sorry I can't remember her name, but she was a professor there, and she did a series of experiments, and she proved that vegetables cooked in a microwave, in effect, because of the same things that Dan was talking about, retain more of their vitamins. People say steaming, but if you steam the thing, look at the water underneath, and it's turned color.
I never want to look at the water underneath my steamed vegetables.
Proved.
And thank God you don't have to,
Cordia. He's approved. But the answer is it changes color. And that color, like beta carotene, is what carries the vitamin with it. So the same thing is true. I thought that there were going to be restaurants with banks of microwaves for exactly the same reason that you're discussing.
And there are banks of sous vide machines.
So that's what I'm saying.
And why aren't there banks of microwave? Why didn't it catch on?
Well, Jeremiah did it.
Jeremiah Tower.
Because he came to see me and I showed him about cooking marrow in the bone. And it didn't get soggy, you didn't get blood all over it, you know, it was terrific. But yes, the first thing I would tell anybody to cook in the microwave is a vegetable. And there are still things that I think it cooks better even than sous vide, which are asparagus, corn on the cob, which you can do right in its shuck, artichokes, and so forth. You have perfect control of timing. You have no water in the environment whatsoever. So that, you know, that wonderful experience of taking an artichoke out of a pan and then it's dripping all over the kitchen or onto the plate of the person eating it. And that doesn't happen with an artichoke that's cooked in the microwave. The color stays better. And it's just better. Asparagus, people are always saying to me, how did you make these wonderful asparagus? There are two answers. Well, three. One, grow it.
Yeah, one, you grew it. Yeah, and you picked it out of your garden, which is the best asparagus on earth.
Second is I peel it. And people say, no, you don't need to, only white asparagus. Big difference. And the microwave oven. I also don't have to tie it in neat little packages. Because it doesn't come apart.
Easy. So, Mario, say that the three of us are agreed that these are the best possible carrots, artichokes, and asparagus. You know, either sous vide, which I bet you do all of them sous vide. In fact, I know for a fact you do artichokes and carrots sous vide.
That's right.
What about asparagus?
No, I don't. I don't.
Try it.
So, okay. You know, say that we've said, oh my God, the intensity, the purity of the flavor, there's just nothing like it. You know, what's your answer to that? That you decide that braises are really better and you should have the melding of flavors that comes with old-fashioned cooking?
I am not opposed to technology. It's easier for me to train 17 people how to blanch a carrot than to buy the machine, train myself on it, and then show them how to do it. So it's easier. It's a path of less resistance the way we do it.
I thought it was romantic with you.
Well, it is romantic too, but easy is very romantic.
Yeah, but there is a difference also. I mean, in other words, you're talking about braising. You're talking about all different kinds of flavor results that you're looking for. We are talking here essentially, I'm talking here essentially, about very simple kinds of preparations. I want to get dinner on the table. Now, there are some vegetables that people will object to because they're not used to the strength of the flavor.
I want to go back to Mario's just saying it's simpler, because Dan's argument, and many of the celebrity chefs now who, like you, have multiple restaurants, but they're in different countries. You know, you can go around on your Vespa, or how is it that you got here?
Vespa.
On your Vespa. I just guessed.
He's a town.
I just guessed. On your Vespa, and you can check in at these restaurants to see how
every day.
How those chefs...
I may not be there during the carrot boiling moment, though.
But you can trust that that... You can trust that
I'll
that
admit
carrot
I miss a few carrots every now and then.
Yeah, you can trust that it is proceeded under your expert and loving and romantic guidance. But many chefs, you know, including Dan, who's only got two restaurants, can say, boy, a piece of foie gras is a really expensive investment. I don't want to lose that money. I'm getting it sourced well, and I'm paying top dollar for that. I want to make sure that it's not lost or wasted. And so I know that in this formula I've developed for sous vide, this many minutes, this temperature, it's going to be perfect and I protect my investment. I use a lot of expensive ingredients too.
I would claim that Dan doesn't do it because he's worried about losing the piece. I would say he's looking for the exalted and maximum quality.
It's never about money.
Right. It can't be. Well, eventually it is. I mean, if you lose 100 foies in a week. No. But I mean, flavor is why he's doing it. He's not doing it just because he likes technology. He's doing it because, in his opinion, it makes a tastier thing. And I'm down with that. And I love that. And I eat at his restaurants. And it is remarkably delicious. My only issue with sous vide as a concept is that there's never very much crust on it. And what I like is a hot roasted rack of lamb that's got burnt bits on the outside that, of course, makes a lot of smoke. And you got to wash the pan a lot more. But I prefer that eating of that lamb. When I'm going to eat a piece of chicken, I'd rather have it the way he's going to do it. Because it's cooked perfectly all the way through and has just the most chickeny flavor.
I'll fight you on the lamb. I mean, I thank you for the chicken, but I'll fight you on the lamb.
All right, thumb wrestle right now.
Because you can do both. You can do both. You can sous vide your rack of lamb, and then you can
then
sear it off your testosterone-driven high heat fire burning thing.
It's hardly worth it.
No, it's funny. All the searing in my family was always done by my grandma, who, as far as I can tell, never had any testosterone at all.
In my family, it's done by my father.
But in any case, the thing is that a rack of lamb in a hot, really hot oven, because I wrote that book too, takes exactly 14 minutes. So you're not really saving any time. And that's what I was getting at before when I said it's a question of what result, what flavor, what thing you want. Not only is not every technique, to me, good for every ingredient, but it's not for every flavor, result. Mm. There are times when I'd rather have that rack of lamb cut into chops, little baby ones like in Italy, in the spring. Heaven!
I'm crying. But Dan, you're playing with fire with this, so to speak, with this moment where you sear things, because everybody wants a seared crust, right? Everybody at his restaurants wants a seared crust because it's a little alarming to have the beautiful white piece of chicken that kind of looks like an oversized Q-tip. You want that skin on it, and you are getting it. But you've also said that your meat chefs and you have to be hugely careful when it comes out of the sous vide bag, perfect texture, perfect temperature, but you want to get that seared moment. Because if they do it like 2 minutes too long, they've ruined the whole thing, right?
Right, but that's true of an open flame as well. I mean, I think I was talking to you at that moment about cooks who come to me from a tradition of very high heat cooking and open hearth cooking, which I adore. I mean, I'm on the fence here. I'm just playing a part. But you know, they can't then come into my kitchen and act that out with the with the searing hot pans and the smoking oil because you. Yeah, I don't think that's the way to cook. I think it's an emotional response to
the oven. In other words, when I did 500 degrees in my roasting book, right? What is that man doing to you? The question was that people thought I even had one reporter saying I was doing it for the publicity. And I said, I guess this person has never been in a professional kitchen. You don't play around with the temperatures in the oven. An order comes in. Do you mean to say that that oven is then going to go down in temperature and up in temperature? If I have six poussins, they're going to go in, boom, 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 and they're going to stay there. And if they're properly cooked, then they will have a crisp outside and a very moist inside. And as a matter of fact, I would claim that they're somewhat moister because the subcutaneous fat from the skin melts and goes into it. I don't baste my turkey. Same thing. The fat goes through, comes out. You can pour it out. You can quantify what you're getting rid of.
And you want the intensity of that flavor. But I was thinking about replicability, because you were saying, and teaching, and whether these techniques can be reproduced. You're saying it's easier just to do it in the old-fashioned way with that carrot. But a lot of chefs, including Dan, would say, I can, you know, send an email saying, I've got this formula for cooking this. It took me a long time. I developed it with these machines. And you guys do it just that way. And in a way, you were doing it in the microwave book. The microwave book had endless charts, which I still consult, may I add, in the summer for corn season. I still open up Microwave Gourmet, and I look at the chart for cooking times. And so yours is a very romantic model, which is using the apprentice that you have to learn from Mario. And then you can do it right at the restaurant.
They're still going to have to learn from Mario, because flavor is not something that you can make a prescription for. And in fact, the only problem I would have, and I'm not disapproving of what you do, because I think
it's good to hear.
It's very much like what I do with the microwave. It seems perfectly logical and reasonable to me. But at some point, each piece of something is different. And at that point, there is a question of pushing it with your finger to see how well done it is, or if you're that kind of person using a thermometer, what have you. And that's the greatest problem I have had with the microwave, was that people who had learned to cook in other ways, A, wanted the sensual gratification of the interim thing, and they just didn't trust you. Rini Sachs, a friend of mine, Irene Sachs, who's a food writer, and she writes for the Daily News and all sorts of places as well. And she, after roasting came out, she'd call me and she would say, well, I thought I would add some thyme, because you like your meat rarer than I do.
So you don't mean the herb. You mean she was going to violate your instructions and roast it longer than you said, which I would do with sous vide, by the way.
Well, all right. So what I'm saying is, so the answer
I immediately
is,
wanted to say 5 more minutes.
But you have to know what you're doing, and you have to try it. And then I had taken into account that most people don't like their meat as rare as I do, so I gave a range. But in fact, there is a point at which the texture of that piece of fish is something that you have to perceive.
And all of you have read Bill Buford's Heat, which last brought Mario to this stage, where an enormous amount of that book is talking about trying to understand that whole set of instinct, so that you know that something is done, something that isn't done, all of the various extrasensory or very sensory cues you get from touching a piece of meat, from looking at it, from knowing how that texture is going to be. And that's a lot of what has drawn a lot of cooks to this new technology, is it is this guaranteed, always reproducible way I can get
very
what
important.
I want. But I want to change the subject to Spain, because Spain is Spain is behind all of this. I mean, whenever you're talking about the technology takeover today, not to do with the Cuisinart and the microwave, but sous vide siphons that make those weird foams that appear in so many restaurants. You're looking at a lot of the spillover, that foamy tide from Spain. And both of you have had really close experiences with Spain. Mario went to high school in Spain, so he really knows Spanish food. And Dan has traveled there and really talked to chefs. And I wonder, Dan, what really influenced you? You grew up going to a farm in the Berkshire, so you had very close contact with animals and food and how they were grown. But then and you decided to learn how to cook and train in France. But then, what did you discover when you went to Spain and saw how they were cooking there?
Well, I saw, you know, what I think is sort of the future of food. I mean, I saw a group of chefs, especially in San Sebastian, who are you know, are now acclaimed, but back when I was first traveling there, were doing things that no one else was doing in terms of not so much manipulating flavors, but in terms of cooking techniques, sous vide being one of the applications. But a forward-thinking philosophy about food and taking the sort of traditional French techniques and moving them into a modern context, which to me felt very exciting. And,
but give an example of something you ate that you thought, wow, I wouldn't know how to make that any other way.
So, you know, there was a group of Spanish chefs who came a couple weeks ago to New York to do a series of demos.
And the biggest stars, I don't know if any of you witnessed
this. Actually, it was the top 15 chefs from Spain, the top. And widely considered some of the 15 best chefs in the world. And there's, you know, a little bit of disagreement about that, only because some of them are very far out in their thinking. And I'll give you one example, which is provocative, to say the least. And this guy's personality is very provocative. I won't use his name. But I came to his demo, and he cooked a Belon oyster from Maine. So he's using a sort of semi-local product, roasting it. He actually cooked it sous vide to begin, and then he roasted it to get that crust. And then he served it with a sheath of platinum. Now, of course, everyone was aghast at the sort of look of it. I mean, it looked like something out of the space age. You know, it was this beautiful sheath that covered it. You know, a little bit like napalm, like this. Absolutely.
Like napalm?
Well, maybe that's a bad analogy.
Sticks to your burning arm.
That's a bad analogy, but that's the one I thought of. At any rate,
gold leaf would be a nice
example. Yeah, right. So you ate this thing.
It was the cost thought.
The cost, right? Well, so it described how he did this. It was an absolutely delicious and different way to eat.
You ate it.
I ate it, and then afterwards, you know, I went around to where he was preparing, and on his shelf, he had very freely advertised this bottle of the platinum in its granulated form, and all over the bottle it said, "Warning, not for human consumption." So I tell you that example not because I think this is indicative of the future of cooking, but because I think it's indicative of what I learned when I was there, which is there's a lot going on that's really interesting, like cooking an oyster sous vide and roasting it to get that flavor that we were talking about
So
before.
That far you could go?
I could go as far as creating this sheath that had this crunch of almost eating a shell of an oyster, which is what he was after. So intellectually, it was really stimulating. But the application was all wrong, in my opinion. You know, it was poison, so it's like, you know, what are you doing? So,
and it violated one of the main rules.
Right.
Keep your customer alive.
Right.
Arsenic in all
place. But it wasn't just that. It was that he was advertising that, you know, and that he was proud of that, and that to him it was, you know, something dangerous and something, again, provocative and sort of the sign of the future. And I think that's probably going in the wrong direction. But that's not to dismiss a lot of what I saw both in Spain and what these chefs are presenting, which is a different way to look at food. And some of them are doing it irresponsibly, and some of them I think are doing it brilliantly. And that's the test.
Mario, you have really witness this. I assume you've witnessed what Dan has tasted because you've traveled and you're going to do something on Spain. Mm-hmm. And what do you think of it? You have this real field of comparison as if you grew up there because you did spend an important part of your childhood there.
Right.
How does it strike you now what they're doing?
I think Spain is in an excellent position. I think it's fascinating that the Spaniards and the Europeans and the Michelin guides have embraced this ideology. And I think it's great.
A kiss of death, the Michelin guide.
Well, the kiss of death, certainly in Italy. Not so much in Spain, and certainly not so much in... we'll talk about the Michelin in a few minutes.
There's
something far more interesting going on. Spain figured out about 15 years ago, kind of like England did 20 years ago, that if you stop burning the garlic and stop burning everything, everything tastes good and you have this amazing wealth of products, and you can actually make really delicious food. What happened then, in the same sense that Salvador Dali went off the edge in his little days, and these people are from up and around that kind of an area, they live for a provocation. And guys like Adria, who's everyone heard of, is at this restaurant called El Bulli in a town called Roses, became the godfather of kind of this sense of provocation. And initially his intention was merely to provoke the diner and then give them something to eat. And whether it was absolutely tasty or not wasn't the most important thing. But I think he still is the leader, and he's come around the corner, and I've been there 6 times. And the first time was pure provocation and I loved it. The second time was pure provocation and I didn't love it so much. In the last 2 times that I've been there, he has turned the corner and understood the real nature of the business of restaurants and the ideology of feeding people food. And he has completely re-embraced, although maintaining his technological edge, he has re-embraced the whole idea of hedonism being the main event. And that's really where Spain is going to come to. It's just some characters are going to get there slower than the others. And the process itself is fascinating. And watching them move from, I'm going to bother the customer, I'm going to make the customer happy. I'm going to bother the customer, I'm going to make the customer happy. And they go around in that. And that's a particularly Spanish brain set, too, which is fascinating. So it's one of the coolest places in the world to go.
I have to tell you that when Adria speaks, because I heard him speak in Madrid at this fusion cuisine conference that lots of chefs go to understand what the future of food is, he introduces it with a video. A video of people at his restaurant who are all looking at each other and their food as if it is the new way of going to bed. There is no... Well, I mean, it's the most sensual, as if it's triggered the most sensual possible. I mean, it's almost like watching soft porn. And there's almost no food in it. It's only the sensory reaction that they're having. So he really has embraced, he's really turned that corner you were talking about.
Well, yeah, but he didn't before.
It's a body of work.
He was in the country. And it was singularly one of the most unpleasant dining experiences I have ever had.
And
in my
you presume
life.
By design to provoke you? Do you think he
thought
it was good?
I don't even think it was design. I think it was innate arrogance. We had driven there from Barcelona.
It's still
as
there.
Everyone does.
Yes.
2 hours.
The road was closed. The regular road, so we had to go up a rutted path, and we arrived.
Barbara, I'm going to suggest that the path itself might have wrecked your meal.
No, it's very hard to wreck my appetite.
Okay.
And we got there. It must have been 3:30 in the afternoon, which for Spain,
still in the realm.
It's not a big deal, but we had to get on to France that evening. But I was very tired, I was cranky, and I said to the guy who came to the table,
How hard is it going to be to make this meal great for you? It's going to be impossible.
And no. I got to the table, I said, I'd like to eat something light if I can, and I explained. And the partner said to me, oh no, you have to have the entire menu. It's the only way to understand the philosophy. I had it, but the words that would have come out of my mouth are not repeatable in this auditorium.
And so it was going to be hard to please her. And the converse is, usually when somebody says the very best thing they've ever had, because I wrote a book on coffee, and they would always, let me tell you about the best cup of coffee I had. And I would learn to stop them and say, were you on vacation?
That's right.
Because it always was some place that they had these great associations with. So that has a lot to do with
it. But there's something else about Spanish food, if I can.
Okay, then I want to ask Dan.
Which is that in Italy and in Spain, what has happened with wine has been unbelievably extraordinary. let alone olive oil and the things that they all have always had. But the wine production and flavor and quality has turned around almost 100%. And I think that we cannot talk about food or think about it without taking into account the wine that accompanies it and the provocation, if you want, that wine, great wine, provides to a cook.
Thank you. That's a very good point. Mario was saying that he thought when he was at Adria recently that he's turned the corner more toward pleasing the group. And I recently saw him at an event Dan and I were both at called Terra Madre, Slow Food, which brought together 1,500 farmers and 1,000 chefs, including Dan, but not Mario, you weren't there, all from various villages, from various three-star restaurants, never been outside their country. It was a fascinating thing. But then Dan went and ate at a restaurant that might be really the wave of the future, right? La Francescana, which is near Modena, an area Mario knows like the back of his hand because he lived there.
And I know. And Francescana intimately.
In fact, I wanted to ask you about your experiences there. Dan, tell me what struck you about the application of, you know, these new wave techniques to the food you ate there, and then I want to ask you what you thought about eating there.
Well, it seems to me that with all the talk of technology and the drive towards modernization, there's this sort of what do you call it, bullseye missing, which is there's a bullseye waiting to be hit, which is to apply these modern techniques and marry them with, you know, agrarian ideals of where your food's coming from, how it's being grown, how it's getting to you, its place, its sense of place and locale, and that none of these chefs in Spain were doing that. Maybe for good reason, because their agricultural history is a little shy, especially up north. But at any rate, it seemed to make sense that their drive towards the modern form of cooking didn't include anything about farming. And here was a chef who had and you correct me if I'm wrong, but at least from what he explained, had an intense history with his area, his agriculture, his agricultural tradition.
Well, he's from Modena, which is the agricultural heart of all of great Italian food.
We needed that context.
Parmigiano Reggiano, Prosciutto di Parma, Aceto Balsamico, Tagliatelle al Reggio. I mean, he comes from a place where, like me right now, getting goosebumps. You just get goosebumps when you think about this place.
I thought it was because you're sitting next to me.
No, it's that too. That's this side.
Okay, all right. So here's a chef who took that training and went off to train with El Bulli, with Ferran Adria, for a few years, and a couple of other chefs, and married these two influences into what I think was an extraordinary meal, both philosophically and just hedonistically. It was a delicious experience.
And of course it would resonate with you growing up on a farm and being...
Well, it's exactly what I want to do, but he was just doing it much better. Yes.
Oh.
No,
and,
really.
And Mario, did you have any of that interest and experience? Because Mario has really cooked this Lyon gastronomic heart of Italy food.
I love Massimo. I love his ideology. I love his passion. And his five textures of Parmigiano Reggiano is an eye-opener to this whole idea of what you
can
do.
Is one of them a foam?
One of them is a foam. And it's right. Not all foam is right. I've had smoked water foam that sucked badly. But the tragedy for me about La Francescana is its three-block proximity to Osteria Giusti.
Yeah, of course.
Which
I've eaten
is the other end of the spectrum in the technology world. And you don't have to choose. But if I did choose one, I would say when I go to eat in Europe, I'm looking for something that both speaks to the place and the creativity of the chef or the patron. But mostly what I want to taste is tradition and not so much innovation. I could not say, though, that one meal was better than the other because they were both perfect.
Or you could be with Jeffrey Steingarten and go to both, which is what we did.
Well, right, exactly.
Or
after lunch, right?
No,
early lunch,
we went
late lunch.
Two dinners.
I had two dinners.
Right, and that's
there,
the way to go. That's the way to really understand it, is to see both sides of that coin. Because they are radically different.
But you see, I only went to Giusti because Massimo said to understand where I'm coming from, you got to go here first.
Right.
So we went at 5:30.
Right.
Okay, so you will send people where before they come to you, where you've evolved this cuisine. Exactly, and they're right next door to each other.
Yeah.
We have a few minutes to open it to questions, so does anybody have any questions? And you're going to have to get the mic if you want to ask questions. There's a mic. Any questions? Provoking them.
Maybe we should wake them up, Corby.
We've got somebody there. No. Go ahead. We have a gentleman here. Yes, he does.
This is not a question. It's a declaration.
The next will be a question, I hope.
This is the most interesting and passionate lecture, seminar, whatever you want to call it, that we've ever attended at the library, and I want to thank you for it. It's really wonderful.
See, that's better than the
to
question.
Hear people.
Great. No one's going to be wrong.
It's really wonderful to hear people talk about something that they know in an articulate, intelligent, and humorous way. Very difficult to do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. My God, I couldn't ask for anything better.
And
we want to go on that note, but we've got a few more minutes for questions if anyone has any.
What about gluttony? How can you have a 10-course meal and then follow it with another 10-course meal
two hours later
and taste anything?
This is just the incredible Trencherman's question. So since you both have done this, how do you do it?
I can't do two meals in one period. And in all honesty, when I go to 1 3-star Michelin restaurant, I can't go to 1 at lunch and 1 at dinner. It's sensory overload for me, as well as the fact that at a certain point in Europe, when you're eating these really fancy meals outside of a couple of the places, a lot of it's based on protein, particularly in Italy. So you're looking for a lettuce leaf. You're begging for a carrot.
Well, no,
there
is another issue. I've gone, for instance, I've had many different lives. And it depends what you're going to the restaurant for and how you pace yourself. I once did a review for Vogue of LA restaurants, and I went to 3 or 4 restaurants at a meal period. And the same thing with Miami, when Miami was just beginning to happen from my point of view.
But this was your journalistic responsibility, obviously.
Absolutely. And the last place I went to in Miami was called Il Tulipano, which is an Italian place that has very robusto, lots of stuff. And by then it was the 5th dinner, I think, and the 10th meal of the day or what have you. And I was with a woman who is a food writer down there. And she was about to go off to the hospital, leaving her children and her husband and so forth. So I said to him, would you put this in a container so I can take it home? Or I can take it with me. And he looked smitten to death, but he did it. Of course, in Miami, everybody takes half the meal home. The older population.
And they get there at 4:30.
Right.
And it's not because they were dancing till 9 on Sunday morning.
So in any case, we get to the car, we open the car, and it is full, absolutely full of takeout containers. And he looks at me as if I'm mad. And I finally explain this to him. But it's a question of pacing. And even at a great, great restaurant, I don't like to be overfed. You certainly don't. I love to eat a lot.
Maybe he does.
He just has a wonderful metabolism.
Exactly.
Lucky son of a bitch. But I don't think that loving food and tasting it and eating it and even eating sometimes too much of it is really about gluttony. I think it's about pleasure and voluptuousness and all sorts of other things. And if, in fact, people are gluttonous, I don't think they enjoy it as much.
No, I have to agree. We've got one more question, but I'm going to pick up something from that before we go. What's that question? This will be our last. Wait, you need a microphone? Who's going to get that gentleman a microphone?
We have 2 microphones here.
Uh-huh.
2 questions.
Okay, we'll come back to you then. I'm just giving permission for now.
I'm writing a book on nutrition, and so I'm going to ask a question that you may not particularly like, but how do you combine gourmet cooking with health?
I can assure you everybody here has got an answer to that. So go right ahead.
Well, I wrote one book with the most awful title. I didn't choose the title.
It's a good book.
It was the book after Microwave Gourmet, and I wanted to call it Micro Slim Gourmet. And everybody, once you're successful, everybody has an opinion. The bookseller, the book club, the salesman,
the reality
whatever.
Of the book business.
And it came out, oh, and Corby.
I didn't name this book, but
well,
I remember the
you
title.
You were involved because I was going to then call it, in desperation, The Healthy Microwave Gourmet. And he said, you can't use the word
it's healthful. It's
yes.
healthful.
So I had to change it once again.
It's healthful.
The answer is there's nothing unhealthful about wonderful food. And in that book, I give the readout of everything. Now, there are things we should not eat. We should not eat too many saturated fats, although we don't have all the answers yet. It turns out that coconut cream and coconut milk are perfectly all right. Everybody was feeding people polyunsaturated fats. I said then they were terrible, and they're still terrible. They don't taste good either. But the answer is it's not hard to cook wonderful food in a healthful style. And I think that is just a question, like any of these technologies, any of these ideas, of applying the intelligence and the imagination and getting the result. And I don't think anybody that I know, now maybe dessert is a problem.
Yeah, but dessert is a sacred topic. We're not going to get into dessert.
All right.
But before opening a can of an unhealthful coconut oil, let's go on to coconut milk.
Well,
let's go on to...
we know what book, what kind of book of nutrition he's writing? Can we
Gourmet
ask that?
Cookie.
He'll come up and tell... I assure you, Barbara's been to many panels in Washington about nutrition when she was doing the Microwave Gourmet Health Style Cookbook. That was the title. And you could get that. And we have a question right here.
Earlier, when you were talking about sous vide and microwaving, there was a lot of talk about sort of pure flavors, like pure carrot and pure asparagus. Can you maybe discuss if there's a difference between pure flavor and good flavor?
Under what conditions?
No, I want to ask Mario that, because
okay.
he was the one who wasn't emphasizing pure flavor, whether you get it in a microwave or a sous vide bag. But I bet you would think a lot about good flavor.
I would say that pure flavor would be good flavor, but I would say that the flavor that you're looking for mostly, particularly when we're talking about regional cooking, is the flavor of a specific region. So I'd rather have my asparagus grown in the Berkshires than I would have it grown in Atlanta, because I'm looking to capture the pure flavor of the smell of the wind on a Thursday right before it's going to rain in this region. And that is a far more important credo to me than the purity or the ubiquity of a certain asparagus nest. I'm looking for more that asparagus and that apple and that wild striped bass than salmon from here or there or apples from Washington or there. I'd rather have an apple from here, even though I'm from Washington, because I'd rather capture that flavor. That's where I'm going with flavor.
And I was speaking of something much more specific in the carrot example, which is that you taste more carrot in the carrot. It's more carrot-y. And so, you know, what's interesting about that, and what I think maybe connects to the nutrition question or suggestion about can you be nutritious and eat gluttonously, you know, that you can use this technology to further the trueness of flavors and get more of that carrot flavor through this technology, just as through farming, through agriculture, you can grow nutritious carrots and carrots that taste more of themselves, whether you're doing it in a small biodiverse farm or you're doing it organically or you're doing it locally, 100 different ways. That technology and good farming actually are quite close. They seem to be so far away that you know the ideals of old world thinking about food and agriculture is blessedly different from using platinum on an oyster. But in fact, combining some of these ideas of technology and old world farming are quite close. And
Dan
I think is the future
closed
of food.
The circle. So we will close our circle and we can return to open hearted and open hearth cookery, an expression I love, and go back to it with new enjoyment of both technology and farms. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, my hour.
And anyone who's here now and would like to, after gluttony, go to diversity, and from diversity quite naturally go to lust, and from lust, of course, go to Freud, is welcome to stay on. Thank you very much.